from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1998 when This American Life went to camp. Specifically, Ira Glass and his team wanted to explore the bonds created at camp and why so-called camp people just don't get non-camp people and vice versa. They encountered kids from a variety of camps across the country who raved about their experience, who never wanted to go home, who built lifelong friendships. But along the way, they also discovered just how strong the Native American imagery and themes were. And here's the problem. Many of the themes were not historically accurate at all. They were used to sell an image. At Michigan's Camp Lake of the Woods, they talked to girls who loved the so-called Camp Powwow. But even then, in 1998, there was pressure to end it. Listen to this portion of This American Life camp episode.
Last year, first session, they took powwow away from us because it was, like, politically incorrect or something. And we were all really upset because powwow is, like, one of our biggest camp traditions. Because we have, like, a little song or whatever in the beginning, and it's really...
Uni kuni cha a uni, a uni kuni cha a uni. Ay 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 iki ay kainu, ay 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 iki ay kainu, a u, a uni kichi.
And you do like different hand motions and everything to it, and it's really fun. And then you like challenge other teams. It's fun. But then second.
Before you continue, can I just say that it's really interesting that you can't even tell the story without suddenly bursting into song.
Our camp sings a lot.
Besides the singing, powwow includes a talent competition. One girl, her talent, she crosses her eyes.
And Jolie can, like, snap her belly button.
Oh, I wear a bathing suit.
And I can sing all the vowels in Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. And you just do weird talent. You just do weird talents and you challenge other teams.
At the end, if your team's the best, you get a peace feather.
The reason it got taken away last year was because a lot of the counselors felt that it was politically incorrect because the speeches that the Indians make are derogatory towards Native American culture, if you look at it that way.
I asked for examples. A few of the girls hold their palms up in the air and say, how? They launch into these fake pidgin English sentences where they drop lots of verbs and add to the ends of the words.
We go to Lake of the Woods, Camp.
Live in Vassar East, I teach camper naps how to walk them on water.
So inside jokes are put into with adding stuff that Indians or whatever.
It's so funny that it's not no one even really thinks about it like that.
In fact, fake Indianness has been a part of camping in America since organized camping began a century ago.
That's Ira Glass, This American Life. And understand something. That was 1998, almost 20 years ago. But today, inaccurate and demeaning use of Native American imagery persists at some summer camps. Yes, we also called that camp in Michigan today, figuring 1998, they were already talking about maybe getting rid of the so-called powwow. And they told producer Megan Mack that it's still there at the girls' camp. They still hold the powwow. It's part of the camp's tradition, and the staff realizes it is culturally insensitive and archaic. They've been trying to phase some of that stuff out, but they just love that powwow. So that has us wondering, what's being taught in schools? Are we supplementing that kind of stuff with accurate teaching of Native history in schools? And the answer is not really. Ask young children what they know about Native Americans. You're going to get a wide range of answers, but not often do you hear an accurate description. They're relying on professional sporting imagery, sometimes summer camp. So who is teaching the truth about Native Americans in public schools? Who's doing it well? And what can we all do better? That's what we want to talk about this hour with our guests that include Peter Jemison, Historic Site Manager for Ganondagan. Always nice to see you, Peter.
Thank you, Evan. Nice to be here.
Michael Galvin is a curator and historian at the Seneca Art and Culture Center at Ganondagan. Michael, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan. Glad to be here.
And Katie McFarland is Director of Professional Development for the Canandaigua City School District. Katie, thank you for joining the program as well.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I have to admit, Peter, we called Camp Lake of the Woods in Michigan thinking they were going to say, look, that was 1998. We understand. And they're going, well, we've got rid of most of the imagery, but they love the powwow. And you listen to that clip, and maybe I'm just overly sensitive myself, but I'm going, I can't believe in 2017 we're still doing this. How did you feel?
Not surprised, that persists. People have a hard time giving up what they imagine to be authentic traditions, even when they know that they're not authentic. They still want to imagine that somehow or other this is, their tradition, and they can't let go of it. We went through this when schools were asked to examine the question around mascots. The ones who were the most vocal were the alumni people who may have graduated 10, 15, 20 years, you know, prior to the date that we were beginning to have the conversation about mascots. They really saw it as you're taking away something from me. I mean, even if they're not in school, obviously, they might attend homecoming or they might go see the teams play. But and so they really were very happy to be able to direct their anger toward me because I was there to discuss the question of the mascots at their invitation, not really to, you know, specifically tell them what to do. The original order came from the Commissioner of Education, you know, to examine the mascots issue.
Michael, what did you think hearing that clip?
Oh, it's brutal. It's brutal. It's sad, really. You know, I think there's a value to tradition, and these camp experiences are powerful times for the students and the participants. But the perpetuation of that kind of stereotyping it has an impact on us. It creates a bias, and even though you may live out your life and not encounter or come in contact with Native people, there are those who do, and it can affect employment. You know, it can affect legal issues, sentencing in a jury selection. Those kind of things affect you. And we need to really examine those kinds of effects and make this a place which is, equitable for all people.
Well, what I want to do, I want to turn to Katie McFarland, but before I do that, I want to read a bit of research on how we teach about Native American history in schools. This comes from Indian Country Today, a study out of 2014. And the headline they had was, "All Indians Are Dead? At least that's what most schools teach children." Here are some of what they found in that study. 87% of references in 2014 to American Indians in all 50 states' academic standards portray them in a pre-1900 context. That means students are graduating from high school without even basic knowledge of contemporary Native challenges or culture. That's why you hear sometimes when you ask young children, "What do you know about Native Americans?" They say, "Well, they used to live here." This study found. A study conducted by Sarah Shear, an associate professor of social studies education at Pennsylvania State, Penn State in Altoona, analyzed state's academic standards, lengthy documents that, of course, dictate what topics teachers should emphasize, including names of important people, dates, events, concept. And the study revealed a very strong lack of anything meaningful when it comes to Native content. She said all of the states were teaching that there were civil ways to end problems and that the, quote, Indian problem was dealt with nicely. The study also revealed that all 50 states lack any content about current Native events or challenges, nothing about treaties, land rights, water rights. Again, this is 2014. You wonder if Standing Rock and other issues might be changing that, but again, that's not that long ago. Washington was the only state to use the word genocide in relation to Natives. That word is used in the standards for fifth grade U.S. history in Washington State. Nebraska textbooks portray Natives routinely as lazy, drunk, or criminal. 90% of all manuscripts written about Native people are authored by non-Native writers. That's what the study found in 2014. Now, Katie, I imagine you've got a different viewpoint on how schools should do it. Why don't you tell me about what Canandaigua has decided to do and to make sure that what you're presenting, both to your teachers to teach and for students to learn, has historical reference, is accurate, and is appropriate?
Okay. Well, first of all, primary focus in terms of curriculum-wise, all of our fourth grade students participate in field trips over to Canandaigua. That's been a very important part of our fourth grade curriculum as it aligns with New York State standards. But really, our focus has also been on pulling it outside of just specific grade levels and to all of our staff. So as part of our new teacher orientation, we've made it a piece of our week. We spend a week prior to school beginning with all of our new staff, regardless of when they've been hired. So even if they were hired halfway through the school year, they join us for that week. And a part of that week, we have a discussion about, particularly about the Braves and the Braves and the logo that we have. Because back when the commissioner was talking about changing logos and Peter approached, I think, the district, there was conversation about what do we do here in Canandaigua and how can we be a part of the solution rather than the problem that was persisting. Mm-hmm. So a lot of conversation was around that, around the logo. A committee was actually developed in the district to talk about that. Students were actually asked what they would like for the logo, and they had a choice between the Lakers, I believe, at the time, which is now FLCC, and the Braves. And the students overwhelmingly asked to remain the Braves. So, but part of that was really important to make sure that if we were going to retain that, what would we need to do and how would we need to honor the tradition of Native American and still be able to keep that Braves, because that's really rich. And we're fortunate in Canandaigua to be surrounded by such deep, rich Native American history all throughout the city. The Canandaigua Treaty in November is signed there. That's a pretty major event that we try to integrate into our students and staff to understand the importance of that. So it was really important for us to have communications with Peter. And I think he's even served on some of those committees back then to figure out how we could honor that name and keep that name and keep that Braves, but also keep that alive. So in our new teacher orientation, we spend a little bit of time explaining to our staff, because many of them don't really know. They have some of those same perceptions. We have schools around us, and they've come from districts that still had that that imagery for their logos. So we kind of go tear it apart and look at it and say, this is what the Canandaigua Braves, what it really means. And it's very important for us to keep that relationship going. So as part of new teacher orientation, we also follow that week where we spend some time talking about it with all of our staff going up to the Canandaigan. And we spend probably half of a day, and the teachers are released. We felt it was that important for them to get that release time to really truly learn about it. And I've gone for the past few years, and it's eye-opening, and it's really a great opportunity to hear firsthand the stories, because it's really very powerful. And that does impact a lot of our new staff, and even the veteran teachers, to go back and really be mindful and thinking about how they're discussing and how the conversations that they're having, regardless of whether they're a social studies teacher or not.
We just talked about the Declaration of Independence. We had July 4th, Independence Day. And I want to listen to the comments made by Michael Oberg, who is a SUNY Geneseo American history professor. He thinks that in many American schools, what we tend to do is we have kids memorize the preamble, but don't really analyze the grievances in the Declaration, which is why on Twitter, when NPR ends up tweeting out the entire Declaration, you had a lot of people saying, wait a second, that's not there. And NPR saying, that's the Declaration of Independence. If we are not familiar with it, what's going on in schools? Well, here's what Oberg has to say about being honest about some of the exclusion and racism from the founders.
The freedom to discriminate was a right that many founding Americans wanted. And then he mentioned, you know, the famous last lines that the king has brought the merciless Indian savages down upon our frontier. Without Native American dispossession, the United States doesn't exist. It's as simple as that.
Okay, do you agree with that?
I absolutely believe it, yes.
And do you think students are graduating with that idea and that knowledge?
I would like to think that we are trying to do a good job of that, but we can only do what we can do. So we do our best with what we have and the restraints that the state give us, but certainly it's an important part of our work.
Okay. Peter, how do you feel about the work that you've been doing with Canandaigua?
Well, I think it's a good step, you know, to actually bring in teachers who are new to the district and really talk about, you know, this being original Seneca territory, Onunda Watga for us. And I always emphasize, among other things, the Canandaigua Treaty being signed in that city and its importance, it being such a unique document, a seminal document, you know, of the United States. I think it's a step in the right direction, and, you know, it was the compromise we reached at the time to find a way to accommodate the idea of retaining the name Braves. And, you know, my continuing concern was that at an occasion like a homecoming or a championship game or something, someone will still wear something that's actually inappropriate, and you don't really get a chance to discuss that in that setting. You know, you don't just go and confront somebody with that. But it is important that Canandaigua still sees the value in what their logo looks like and trying to define that for the people who come into the system and for the students, too. You know, this whole question, Evan, about the dispossession and you know, how that leads to the development of the United States. I mean, that is so important to understand. When people talk about the Revolutionary War, so much time is spent on the grievances with the king and the taxation and the, you know, whether or not you had to accommodate soldiers, you know, from the British in your home and things like that, not really getting down to the real discussion, which is who has the right to take this land from those people who are preventing us from spreading westward, you know, and then viewing this as the spoils of war, you know, once it happens. And Washington's direct orders to lay waste to our land, leave not a mouthful of food, you know, these are real. And, you know, they occurred. And I think that these are the stories that are much harder for the average American to accommodate, much harder for the average school system to make a part of their curriculum.
Michael Galbin, when it comes to the Native imagery and when it comes to mascots, you know, I think Peter didn't say this outright, but I wonder if both of you would say, we'll work with any district if they're going to retain certain names, Braves, et cetera. But would you prefer, in the long run, we get rid of that, we phase it out as mascots entirely?
Yeah, I do. With all due respect, the term is a bad choice. And to ask and invite a vote from people who it does not directly affect, whether or not that's an appropriate name or mascot, it seems strange to me. So I would encourage the district to reevaluate their choices and, you know, not simply sit back and think that, well, the matter is settled. I really do think that to be a facility which is focused on education and enlightenment, that to reevaluate what you've been doing in your practices is the best way to be that service provider for your community. And yeah, I'd prefer it be some other name.
Now, I want to read a note that we got from a fourth grade teacher at Northside School in Fairport. And by the way, I have to say, one of the things we asked Peter and Michael was to help us see which districts are doing it well. And I know that despite the fact that, you know, Michael, Peter, many of our Native American friends would say the same that Michael just said, which is ultimately they'd love to phase out those mascots entirely. But at the very least, do you have the self-awareness to say we need help in making sure that if we're going to keep it, we're going to try to work with this in a historically accurate sense? And there was some appreciation that Canandaigua was at least doing that. Well, they also pointed to Fairport. And I got a note from Deb Catalano, who's a fourth grade teacher at Northside School in Fairport. Peter, you know her?
Yes, know her very well.
Okay.
Been working with her for many years.
Let me just read. We got a long email from Deb, and I'm just going to pull a paragraph and read it, and we'll get our panel's thoughts on this. She writes, quote, what offends one person does not another. So how do we teach history in the classroom if we are afraid of saying or doing the wrong thing? I believe that we need to acknowledge different viewpoints and encourage kids to think through different perspectives. In my fourth grade class, we talk about stereotypes, and we try to see events through many different lenses. We talk about the establishment of reservations. I do an activity where I get phone calls from a friend. They sit on the line while I have a conversation meant for the kids to hear. I tell them that we were just told that another classroom needs one of our five tables, so one group of students has to leave all their things and move to another table. This happens two more times, until I have 24 kids sitting around two tables. You can imagine how grumpy 9 and 10-year-olds are, and how they are not shy about sharing how unfair it is that they have to give up their tables, especially since they had them first. When we relate this back to Native people, they are all ready to make sure that we give back all the land, until I ask them if they would give up the land that they live on now. This creates a great discussion, and it allows them to begin to understand a story through multiple perspectives. This continues when we talk about European exploration and westward expansion. Encouraging kids to look at stories from different perspectives gives them opportunities to understand that the Native people living on this land did not need to be saved, and when the, quote, savage Native people attacked poor colonists and early pioneers, there was probably more to the story, a previous attack by the colonists that goes unmentioned in the history books as one example. That's just a, that's one of the paragraphs she sent. Peter, you're smiling over there. You want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I really admire the work that Deb does. She takes the extra, goes the extra mile, you know, to really help the kids come to understand something by that illustration she used. You know, instead of telling somebody something, when you illustrate it for them and they have to do something physically and actually experience it, I think it sort of brings the idea home, you know. And whenever we talk, I go to the school. Prior to their visit to our site, and they bring all the fourth graders on one day, as Canandaigua does as well, or is now 2 days, I guess. Prior to their coming, I go to their Northside school, and I meet with teachers, and I meet with parents and students, and we try to bring something new into the conversation before they come to visit us, and I try to draw from the students what they know and hear from them, and then answer questions afterward as well. But there's that opportunity for dialogue. There's that opportunity for talking. There's that opportunity to reach the parents. You're not preaching to the choir. You're preaching to people, or you're talking to people who are not informed. They may be the parent of this student, but they themselves do not have, you know, the background or the knowledge. And you get that unique opportunity to really direct it to the parents who are going to bring their children, and we can discuss what is the value of this? Why should you bring your children to this site? Why should this site exist? What does this site do that no other site does in this area?
And Deb's got students in probably in 5 minutes, they're feeling, if they're rubbed the wrong way just by having to sit in this more snug table space and the feeling that's unjust, that maybe actually feeling that unfairness is a way to get a 9 or 10 year old to kind of get outside themselves and start thinking, oh, okay, for 5 minutes, if I was this upset about this, what would it have been like? On the flip side, Peter, I read from that survey that 87% of American, you know, school standards presents Native American story pre-1900. Yeah. So does that surprise you? Do you think most American kids in public schools are growing up thinking, well, Native Americans used to exist or are part of the past?
If you look at the textbooks, unfortunately, the textbooks often talk in the past tense. They don't really try to talk about the present tense. Now, I think there's been some improvements, but there still is a lot of emphasis on past tense. And a lot of emphasis on things like, you know, I wish I could remember this quote. We did a program with the Rochester City Schools, and we went to the school, and there was a quote like, Native Americans looked with amazement upon the Europeans. Okay, this was one of the lines in there. I mean, I think there were probably a lot of things that we thought that didn't include amazement. But this is the kind of, you know, the way in which to present it and to sort of soft pedal the kind of real, you know, interaction that took place, sometimes in a positive manner that took place, sometimes in a manner which had to be confrontational because they're coming on to the land which we're occupying and disregarding the fact that we're living there, thinking of it as an unmanaged environment, not realizing our sense of property, our sense of how you manage this is totally different. It does not include these ideas of property that Europeans were used to, property law. Even those who were coming here as, you know, immigrants and trying to reestablish a new place to live.
And so what's the consequence, Michael Galvin, when students hear about everything in a pre-1900 context?
It is, you know, from a practical standpoint, we've seen over the last 25 years students coming through Ganondagan. We've seen a change. There's some schools who really emphasized that aspect of their education, and so we do get some students that are better informed than others. But the historic context that Native people are presented in is such a strong message to them that we start out a program inviting the students in and explaining who we are. Our interpretive staff are all Native Americans. They explain who they are, their nation, their clan. And then we spend a day with them, essentially, a couple of hours anyways, and then wrap it up. And the students sometimes do not understand that they have been talking with a Native person the entire time, even after you emphasize it. So we try to double emphasize it and try to get through to them.
because they think, and they've been learning, that Native Americans are part of the past?
Well, yeah, there's a visual perception, a stereotypical perception, and then maybe even more harmful, that the person standing in front of you isn't truly a Native American, because, look, they don't have buckskins, there's no feathers, and so forth. And that's it's a problem that we face, we're trying to remedy, you know. And on the other hand, when you get into a school district, school districts have Native American students in them. And they may not self-identify. They may not look classically Native American with braids and dark skin. It doesn't make them any less Native. These students are sitting there as an invisible minority, half of the time really reticent to identify themselves because they know the kind of ridicule that they will receive. And this happens.
Yeah, I just wanted to emphasize Michael's point. I've just had one student graduate from Victor and another student who is now a sophomore in Victor, who has grown up in my home. And the students, for the most part, refused to believe that basically my niece was Native American. You know, they just absolutely never accepted the idea, especially when she was younger, that she could be a Native American. You know, what they individually thought or why they formed that opinion, you know, I can't really say. Interestingly, my nephew, in discussing this very recently, was saying that in his experience through elementary school, he learned a lot less about his own tradition and a lot less about our history through the classes that were supposedly devoted to history, you know, and devoted to the history of America, than he did in one literature course where there was a discussion of a novel that was, you know, that had a Native American theme to it. He got more from that discussion than he did from anything he had picked up previous to that. And I think he's another one, as Michael said, who he would probably tend to downplay it just so that he doesn't have to deal with, you know, the criticism or the, or even worse, you know, the teasing or whatever it might be, bullying.
And Katie McFarland from the Canandaigua City School District, one of the things that survey also uncovered was that in various states where there is a bit more, I guess we would say it, progressive or historically accurate and culturally accurate education, there are parents who push back and say, well, you're making my child uncomfortable. You know, this is not the America that I remember hearing about in textbooks. And why are you doing this? Have you had any pushback from parents when it comes to any aspect of the discussion, whether it's the logo, whether it's what's taught, anything like that?
Definitely not since I've been in the district. So okay. I've been in the district about 5 years now. So to me, I've known nothing else, and my children go to Canandaigua as well. They've known nothing else besides the Canandaigua logo and the things that they learn in the curriculum in school. So I haven't experienced that, and I'm not aware of any currently that goes on. We really try to make as many connections as we can with parents and families. It starts with what we can get our hands around, which is the teachers, and then have the teachers keep that constant communication with parents and families around these. I said, we have such a great gem in our backyard and throughout the city of Canandaigua, all of these historical sites and happenings, that it's really great to rely on and contact with Peter and Michael and the staff at Ganondagon to help promote families and parents and the community to really take advantage of and understand the Native American culture through the eyes of the actual Native Americans, as opposed to what they've heard and seen. So we do our best through community outreach, working with parents and families. But I have to say that I haven't had any pushback per se. In fact, it's been more of an embracing of and trying to understand and honoring what it means to be a brave and concentrating on that. And that was the compromise that we made. And we are happy to have that Braves logo. But we also, you know, we have part of that is the belt. And we talk about that with our students. And so families in the community, from my perspective, have really tried to understand it a little bit better. But we are very fortunate to live in the city of Canandaigua, where so much live history is still breathing there. So it's been a positive experience. Could we do better? Absolutely. I think that the more education that we give, the more that we collaborate with Ganondagan and with the Native American people that we have in our community, I think the better off we'll be.
All right. I want to get our only break of the hour in. And if listeners, if you want to weigh in, I'd love to hear from you. I'm getting some emails from you, but you can call the program as well. What did you remember learning about Native American history in school? Maybe your kids, what are they learning? Are you concerned that it's not a historically accurate picture? How's your district doing? 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. And before I go to break, I have to tell you that, you know, Peter and Michael have stressed site visits are great. They should be a starting point. We need to do a better job in every classroom in this country. But speaking of site visits, the 26th Annual Native American Dance and Music Festival at Ganondagan is this weekend. So it's a fun opportunity and a great opportunity for families, for anybody who wants to learn about artists, singers, musicians, dancers, storytellers. It happens, Peter, Michael, 10 to 6 both Saturday and Sunday. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
10 to 6. Tickets are available at the day of the event. If you're a member of Ganondagan, it's free admission. Adults, $12. Seniors, $10. Students, $18 and older, $7. Children, 3 to 17, $5. Kids, 2 and under, are free. Everything's there at ganondagan.org. And Peter, what's the most exciting part for this for you coming up this weekend?
Well, the new thing that we are doing this year is we are doing a Haudenosaunee art show. It's a juried art show. It's the first time we've done that. We've asked our artists to submit work that will be juried by three people, and we'll select winners in four categories, I think it is, Michael, and we'll select also a best of the show. And we just kind of want to elevate the awareness of Haudenosaunee artists. We want to also acknowledge those that are doing exceptional work. And we want to encourage our artists at the same time because there'll be the opportunity to purchase their work. Their work will be in the spotlight a bit more than ordinarily, you know, at our festival. And I think all of that will lend itself toward, you know, sort of raising the perception of our artists and also making more people aware of the artists who are active and working today in the present. This isn't work that's, you know, past tense. We're asking for new work, basically, for them to submit. And I'm pleased to say that we, even though we're doing it for the first time, we've gotten some very beautiful entries, and I think people will be surprised and pleased to see them when they're there. You know, we're also, for the first time, bringing the Akwesasne Women Singers, a Mohawk group from the community. Some refer to as St. Regis, and others call Akwesasne, the Northern New York Mohawk community. And I think it's great to have them. Their lead singer is Bear Fox. We're happy to have them come to the show this year. And then, you know, the other thing is, of course, the craftsmen that we'll have set up, the food that we'll have there, our storytellers. I mean, each of those things have their audience, you know. And we have a lot of activities, hands-on things that people can visitors can do with their children while they're there.
All right, Ganondagan, 10 to 6, Saturday and Sunday for the 26th Annual Native American Dance and Music Festival this coming weekend. Let's get that only break. We're going to come back to some of your questions and comments that have already come in. And we'll also see what Peter and Michael think in particular about American summer camps, how they feel about some of the imagery. We told you about Lake of the Woods in Michigan, but certainly other camps use some of the imagery. So we'll answer more of those questions as well after our only break of the hour. Coming up in our second hour, where are the protagonists of color? Where are the heroes of color? Where are the authors of color when it comes to children's books? When it comes to high school literature and reading lists? Why is it still so white? Well, the industry publishes more than 3,000 children's books a year, but also when you look at high school reading lists, there's still not a lot of diversity. What would it take to change that? We examine it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Peter Jemison is historic site manager for Ganondagan, and Michael Galban's a curator and historian at the Seneca Art and Culture Center there. Katie McFarland, Director of Professional Development for the Canandaigua City School District. And I want to take a couple of your comments and questions. I'll start on Twitter with Trish, who says, what about the Red Jacket School District? She said, Red Jacket's teams are the Indians. And she said, our signs out here say you're an Indian country. And in her words, it makes me stabby. I think she's saying she gets very frustrated or offended by that. And Peter, you were saying the signs, I guess, they show up on lawns in a lot of places. Is that right?
Yeah. If you drive through, you know, basically Shortsville and that area, you're going to see these signs out on the lawns. I think it actually says Indian Nation, you know, and it's a red sign. But Michael has a story that I think we should hear.
Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
So Red Jacket did send their students last winter, and we're real happy. We're really inviting to any school to talk about Ganondagan and history, Seneca people in particular. And I questioned the class, which was fourth grade class, and about a dozen parents, what they knew about Red Jacket. I said, you come from the Red Jacket school. What do you know about Red Jacket? And none of the students knew a thing. I asked the parents, and the parents didn't know anything either. And then I asked the teacher about Red Jacket, and the teacher wasn't aware of it either. So I knew at that moment that I had to throw out of the window anything I wanted to talk about related to Ganondagan and focus on the actual name of their school in honor of a man who played an important role during the time of the American Revolution for Seneca people. And I spent a lot of time talking about him, his accomplishments. And fortunately, we were in front of a very large painting in our classroom, and I could point out the person representing Red Jacket in the painting for them and explain about Canandaigua, the Canandaigua Treaty, relationships between Native people in the United States. And I think they were pretty much sick of me by the end of the end of the program. But I realized that was a serious shortcoming, and they had to do a lot of work. But I was very grateful that they were able to come to Ganondagan because we were one of the few places that it could actually talk about it.
Nobody from Red Jacket, not even the teachers, knew the history?
No, not a one.
Wow.
That's unbelievable.
It's the name of the district.
I know. The name of the school.
Wow. But Michael, you made a point. I want to stress this. Any district that calls you, and it doesn't have to be a district with any Indian imagery in the name or the mascots, they want to teach it. Every district should want to teach it well and historically accurate. Any district that calls you, are you happy to take that call and help?
Absolutely. If we can fit you into the schedule, we want you at Ganondagan. Give us the chance to talk about this. Give us the chance to talk about our own history. We understand it, and we're the most qualified, actually. And we're even happy to talk with teachers outside of a program to help them shape their curriculum.
And what about, go ahead, Peter.
So one of the things I wanted to add was we used to be limited to a six-month season because we were primarily an outdoor site. That all changed when we opened up the Seneca Art and Culture Center, which gives us an indoor venue and also gives us access to the exhibits and gives us access to a model of a bark longhouse so that in the off season, you know, students can come in and programming can take place so that they don't all have to try to fit themselves into the spring or the fall of the year. And there's, because that naturally there's only a certain number of days and we can't accommodate everyone we would like to given that limited time. So that's something if there are teachers out there listening, I hope they're aware that we will do programming with you. There's only one period of time in the middle of the winter that we are not open.
Are you hearing from more districts as time goes by, at least asking questions about this?
Well, the one that's really opening up for us is the Rochester City School District. You know, we would get individual classes, but now there's really an effort that the entire fourth graders of the Rochester City School System will begin to come to Ganondagan. And obviously we're going to have to, you know, work out accommodations so that we can have enough days for them. But that's a big opening. That's a lot of students. And I think it's an important audience that, you know, we've only really touched on.
Katie, would you describe, before I go back to some listener comments here, Katie, what would you describe as the biggest benefit that you see, not only for students when they go to get on again, but staff, teachers as well?
I think it's an opportunity and awareness because they experienced a completely different understanding of the Native American culture regardless of, I mean, within the past 10 to 15 years even, I could say that the pictures and the things that, that our staff have learned about are not as accurate as they came to believe. So that is really, truly why doing this with our new staff, it's our opportunity to make sure all of our staff are aware, because they're on the ground floor. They're the ones who can communicate and share the stories with the students. And then, therefore, the students get excited. Certainly, even they get excited when we go to Gnadigan. They get excited and they start to say, oh, well, I'm going to go, I would like to go outside of school. So it generates that excitement and enthusiasm, but truly that awareness.
And I mentioned off the top of the show that when we do a poor job of teaching Native American history in our schools, it leaves it to sometimes kids seeing school mascots or professional sports, and sometimes summer camps, and sometimes the imagery is offensive or it's inaccurate, it's crude. You saw that at Camp Lake of the Woods in Michigan, and they're still doing the so-called powwow there. But I'm wondering if Peter and Michael have any thoughts about, you know, summer camps in general. I mean, I can think of Western New York camps. Some of them, having talked to the directors, have really good intentions. In fact, I can think of a camp that I went to growing up where the director wanted kids to know you were on land that was dispossessed of the Native American people who lived here by white people, and that we need to be honest about this. But they used some imagery that I think now looking back, we would go, I'm not sure if that was, or maybe it was. I don't know how much consulting they did. But Michael, you got a smirk on your face here. Tell me your thoughts about American summer camps and the use of imagery.
Well, it's, I mean, there's two issues I have. You know, one is that the inaccuracy of it all. Okay, so that I have an issue with that, and I'm happy to help. You know, that's part of our function. And the other is sort of like pretending to be Indian, which is another problem, by, you know, putting on some kind of costume or feathers or headband or paint or something that you can become Indian or be assigned into a cabin, and we are the Mohawk tribe now, and you know, this sort of perception that that's all we are is a costume that can be put on and put off, you know. And that creates problems elsewhere, you know, as you describe. If you're not teaching the right, or teaching inaccurate representation of a people, you're leaving it up to cartoons and mascot logos, and you know, who knows what else is getting into your child's minds.
Peter, how do you feel about it?
Well, I've experienced the same thing, and it, you know, I'm going to say I was asked to work with Cayuga College, and Cayuga College had a kind of a tradition of doing what Michael said. You know, they assigned each class one of the six nations. So let's say, you know, the class of 2017 is going to be the Mohawk. And all of them then, you know, have to learn something about that. And then they make kind of a, I don't know, I would call it a paddle, but it wasn't really a paddle in the sense of the fraternities, but it was something that would hang on the wall made by the class of 2017. And we had this long conversation about moving away from that and what would be the thing that could be substituted that would continue to be a unifying idea for students at Cayuga College. And, you know, again, it's like there's still that resistance to the idea that you're going to change all of our traditions. Now, what happens to that wall full of, you know, the ones that were done earlier, and how do we change the whole thinking of the school? And it requires a lot of work. And when they start to think about it and contemplate it, then they start to, I don't know, get queasy about it, I guess you could say. They really have a hard time, you know, accepting that something different could be done. And, you know, and it's difficult to, even the administration, they were hard to bring around to that.
One of our listeners, Joel, points to a book called Playing Indian by Phil Dolores, and that came out in 1999, and actually the Connection staff read a good portion of that book before this program. It doesn't just focus on summer camps. In fact, it focuses on everything from the American Tea Party itself, right, and I don't mean the modern Tea Party, I mean the Tea Party, to the use of imagery in schools, in professional sports, in all kinds of contexts, usually for profit and often with no historical accuracy. So the book's called Playing Indian, and it is definitely worth checking out. This is Joan and Hilton. Go ahead, Joan.
Hi, Peter, Mike, and Evan. I just want to tell you, I love the museum. I was there. I spent over 2 hours, and I still didn't see the whole thing yet. I just want to tell you how well done it is. And my brother-in-law and sister know Joanne Shenandoah very, very well. They're very good friends. But the main point I wanted to make is that I know a lot of people, and me and my sister included, always wish we have some Native American blood in us. So I think a lot of maybe European Americans think the same way, and is that maybe why, I hate the word mascot, but anyway, use the image of Native Americans because they kind of have a wishful thinking that maybe that you guys are part of us.
Some thoughts there. Thank you, Jim.
Being a descendant of Mary Jemison, of course, I have many people who believe they are somehow related to Mary Jemison. And it's a popular book. It's been read, you know. I learned myself when I came here how many people read it, as especially young women read it, you know, and loved the idea that she became an Indian, right, by the Senecas adopting her in a full way. I mean, not just, you know, something symbolic, but something they really, from that point on of her adoption, considered her Seneca. And she was given land and rights and responsibilities, the equivalent of any of the other Seneca women. So so when I have people come to me and they are reaching for that relationship, you know, I try not to shut them down because I want to hear what they have to say, and I want to examine how much they really have knowledge of this. There are lots of descendants, you know, of Mary Jemison and on both sides of the river, both sides of the Niagara River in Canada and in the U.S. So it's, you know, and in fact, a lot of people intermarried, you know, and so again, we do have people who, in outward appearance, you might not know that they are Native American, but they could well be. So I think she's got a point that there are people who do feel this and wish they had that connection.
It's an interesting subject that's not quite on target with what we're talking about, but I'll share this, that the early Americans, there was sort of a social stress that took place, and American people early on, as they formed the United States, it seems like they were trying to tie themselves to royal blood in Europe. And families which had those connections held a particular esteem socially. And then in the South, there was this transition towards investigating that royal blood and actually learning that they were, or discovering perhaps that they were descended from Pocahontas, an Indian princess in their eyes. And so it became popular, and it turns out that in the South, at least, in the southern states, a huge percentage of people identify themselves as descendants of Pocahontas. And this might be where this idea of royalty and the love of having that royal lineage comes from. It may be transferred to Native identity, to have that royalty in your bloodline, now being Indian blood.
Barry writes to us and says, when I taught American history and social studies in Rochester schools, students were made to understand that the standard American history features dead, affluent, white, straight, Christian, able-bodied males, but others also helped make America what the country it is today, and such racist concepts like Indian giver were explained within the cultural context for them to understand where the put-down came from and how it is often misused. That's Barry, who is a retired social studies teacher in the Rochester School District. Just about out of time, but Michael, are you an optimist that, as a historian, that schools are going to improve with this? 20 seconds here. What's going to change it here?
Yeah, I think it just takes dedicated teachers. I think it takes investing that time, which is very difficult today in the climate in our educational system. It really does take those key people to seek out that correct path. And I remain optimistic.
Peter?
Last thing I would say is Katie and I were having a conversation, and basically it was, teachers really need to think of this as an honorable profession, a profession that is really important to helping people gain a better understanding of themselves, of their country, and of our history.
Well, and I want to thank Katie for being here from Canandaigua. Thank you for sharing your perspective. Peter and Michael at Ganondagan. And once again, the 26th Annual Native American Dance and Music Festival at Ganondagan is this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, 10 to 6. All kinds of things going on there at ganondagan.org if you want to learn more. Thanks to everyone for being here. Much more Connections coming up.